Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, inviting the public to On Notice, Inside the 60 Days of Forming a Resident-Owned Community, a virtual presentation on May 8th. More details at communityloanfund.org/onnotice.
This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and it's time for the New Hampshire News Recap. It's been a little over a year since New Hampshire Police Department started signing agreements with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement to enforce immigration law, like serving a warrant or arresting someone on suspicion of being in the country without authorization. These are called 287G agreements. ICE also offers at least $100,000 in stipends for these partnerships to cover new vehicles and updates to police equipment. NHPR's Lau Guzman found that at least three local departments have received that money, and they say it's helping purchase things they need. Good morning, Lau.
Hi, good morning, Rick.
So, Lau, about 15 departments in the state have these agreements so far with ICE. Wired reported about a month ago that Carroll Police received $122,000 from ICE earlier this year, one of the first departments in the country, in fact, to get the money. You found out a few more departments have received or are in line for similar stipends. What did you learn?
Yeah, so we have four other departments that have filed for a stipend from ICE for signing up for a 287G agreement. So right now, Colebrook and Candia got the money. Epping and Belknap filed and are waiting. And I'm waiting to hear back from eight other departments, including the state police, about their status.
So how much money are we talking about here? What are these departments getting?
So baseline, ICE offers about $100,000 for joining, plus money for each trained officer, plus bonus money for the number of arrests. So if we look at, say, Candia, Chief Chad Shevlin says they got $115,000, which is about a tenth of their annual operating budget. He said they have three officers that got 287G training but have made no immigration arrests. And I talked to him, and he had something to say.
And if I can save the taxpayer money in order to operationally get equipment to operate day-to-day, that's helpful, right? We look at all kinds of grants, not in stipends, not just through this program.
So, you know, he was very favorable towards this program because it helps them get a new cruiser, which are very expensive. And down the line, if Candia does make an immigration arrest, they can file to get ICE to cover their officers' time spent on this arrest. But it might be a while before these reimbursements materialize, since arrests by the police have only really started in September.
Yeah, Lau, what are our departments doing with this money in general? As you said, they're picking up some equipment they might need. But what else are they doing with this money?
Yeah, so these are generally like big purchases that are like too big to buy in like 1 year, especially a lot of these departments are smaller. They don't have, you know, like infinite money or resources. Look, I was telling you a cruiser is $80,000 to $90,000, and it really only lasts about 4 to 5 years. I also heard about upgrades to IT, comms, holding cell security, body-worn cameras. For instance, Chief Paul Rella from Colebrook told me that he's using at least $40,000 from their stipend to replace these handheld radios that are like 20 years old. So it's things that these departments really, really need.
Yeah, so for these smaller towns, it really is a nice windfall. But did you get the sense, Lau, that departments are joining these 287G agreements because of the financial incentives?
Yeah, that's kind of tough to tell, because most of these departments did join between March and August of last year, and ICE only really started offering these incentives in September. We did see 287G arrests starting in September, but there's kind of no way to tell if that shift is in how the data was collected or if it's part of the cycle of officers getting trained and putting this program in place, or if it was motivated by what ICE calls a performance award for these number of arrests. So I did talk about this with Major Chris Bashaw from the Rockingham Sheriff's Office, and they decided to decline the stipend but might be open for reimbursements. And they talked about how they didn't want it to be perceived like they're using the money because there's this incentive. But they're also open to reimbursements because, you know, down the line, if they start using their program a lot more, they don't want it to come out of their regular budget.
Yeah. So the early days still, as you said, these agreements really just getting going the last few months. But when you're talking to these chiefs, what did they think about the first year of the program, or, you know, the first few months here? And what's been the impact to the communities they serve?
Yeah, I think police generally have a positive view of this program. You know, the extra money, the additional training, the opportunity to collaborate with the feds and detain people that they might have left to go in other years. Like in previous years, ICE wasn't really all that interested in making the drive up from Boston or Manchester, even if local police had given them a call. And I talked about this with Chief Belknap Sheriff Wright. I think I have a kind of tape from him.
We still had contact with illegal aliens here in Belknap County. Difference was ICE agents wouldn't come up to make the arrest, and they didn't offer us 287G.
Yeah, so the difference is just kind of the priorities of enforcing this stuff. But on the other hand, I do think it is kind of creating tension, making local policing more political than it was before these agreements. And, you know, there was some drama around warrant articles during town meeting season. So it's, you know, kind of one of those things that these sheriffs are talking about with their people.
And like so many things in New Hampshire, it's very localized, I imagine.
Yes. Yeah. Every single agency, every single one chief and sheriff that I spoke to had a different view on this and a different idea of what their county or like town needed.
Yeah. And like you said, I think, you know, these are fairly early days. It's really just getting going the last few months. So we're going to be watching for more of your reporting, Lau. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
NHPR is Lau Guzman. You can find more of her work and all of her immigration coverage online at nhpr.org. Lawmakers and advocates are raising fresh concerns about leadership at New Hampshire's state-run youth detention center as authorities continue to investigate a recent series of allegations of abuse against children held there. On Monday, the Disability Rights Center in New Hampshire and the state's Office of Child Advocate, an independent watchdog, said staff at the Sununu Youth Services Center continue to use illegal restraints when kids there do not comply with orders. NHPR's youth and education reporter, Emory Timmons, has been following that story, and she joins us now. Good morning, Emory.
Good morning, Rick.
Remind us what the allegations are at the center.
So I think listeners are probably very familiar with the allegations we've heard about in the past, which were sexual and physical assault allegations over decades. This looks a little different now. The child advocate really raised two questions and concerns. One is earlier this year, about 15 youth who are at the center were in lockdown for 6, maybe 8 weeks. And during that time, you know, they couldn't get outside. They weren't getting their education classes. So a lot of isolation there. And the second incident involved a child who suffered a broken bone while he was being held in a prone restraint by staff for 3.5 minutes. And at that time, the nurse looked at him through glass. That was his medical exam in that incident. He did not get treatment for another 48 hours. And so while the abuse looks different, this is coming at a time where the state has committed to creating a much more trauma-informed, you know, a system for these children, recognizing that these children are coming in with a lot of history of, you know, difficult lives, possible abuse themselves. And so it's coming at a time when the state has really said we're committed to this not happening anymore.
You reported that the Disability Rights Center says that they have held recent interviews with children and staff and that they indicate kids continue to be abused and subject to seclusion at the center, like the case you were talking about, even after the New Hampshire Attorney General's office said last week there was no abuse occurring at the facility. So what does the AG have to say about these allegations now?
They've really only said that there is no abuse continuing. The executive council last week, Counselor Karen Leo Hill especially, really pressed the AG's office. You know, what is happening now? What are you doing now? What does your investigation look like? And on two occasions, the attorney who was there said there is no abuse happening. And that's just counter to what the Disability Rights Center is hearing from youth who are there.
Yeah, there was a legislative hearing about it this week. What are lawmakers saying?
I think I left that two-hour meeting really with two impressions. They're very concerned and they're very frustrated. So they heard from the child advocate, but also the head of DCYF, which oversees this facility. You know, the advocate went through all the incidents that she's seen, the investigation that she's done. A lot of concern there. And lawmakers were very frustrated that the chief of DCYF would not answer a lot of questions. And that was because the AG's office has said not to because we're investigating. But the lawmakers are very concerned here as well, and they want to get to the bottom of this, but they're not getting the answers they want. They also express real questions about the leadership of that center and of the state over this facility. The new director, I looked into his background, and his resume indicates that he's never worked inside a residential treatment facility, and he has little to no experience with juvenile justice. I tried multiple times to reach him to talk through that, and he declined comment.
So what are lawmakers, what are authorities, what's the governor saying they're going to do about this then?
They just keep saying we are investigating, you know, please be patient with us. We need to get to the bottom of it, of this. The Department of Health and Human Services has said, you know, we're not pausing and waiting to make changes. Those are in place now. We're starting them. We're aware that this is a problem. But at the same time, the Disability Rights Center says their conversations with children suggest that's not happening or not happening fast enough.
Yeah, I know you've been reporting on the training that staffers at the center receive, too. Can you tell us about that training?
Yes, it's called Controlled Force, and it's very military-style training. There is some de-escalation training in there, according to the materials that we looked at online. But there's also, you know, you learn how to do, quote, takedowns and handcuff techniques and arrest tactics. So some of that feels very counter to what you would think about in a youth treatment center. And that training has been a concern for the Disability Rights Center back to 2010. And we know it continues because there's a training schedule for next month with this same program.
All right, we're going to be following more on this story. I know that Anne-Marie, you're going to stay on it as well, and we're looking forward to hearing more from you about that. I do not want to let you leave, though, without a very positive story that you covered this week. There was some good news for the city of Franklin. Anne-Marie, you were at Franklin High Wednesday. They talked to students after they were surprised with the news that their school was named Top High School of the Year. What was the reaction?
Oh, they were so proud of their school, and it was so nice, like, to be able to bring listeners a positive story in this world right now. They say, well, we know our high school is great, but this tells the world that someone else thinks so, too. So they were just very proud. One student I talked to texted his grandmother right away to tell her.
That's great. You're right that it was some welcome news for a district that it's known for budget cuts, low teacher pay. What's been happening at Franklin High that's, you know, driven these changes?
Well, it's interesting. I covered Franklin many, many, many years ago when I was at the Concord Monitor. And at that time, the district had the highest dropout rate in the state. You know, there were fights. It was just a school that was, you know, problem school was how people saw it. They've really rethought leadership, approach to education, I'm sorry. They don't have any more money to do it, but they've now make every decision based on these two questions. What should Franklin High graduates be able to do, and what should they know when they graduate? And so that's really taken the approach to education past academics. There's a lot more, you know, outside the classroom learning, internships, interviews with local businesses, independent art projects. It's almost struck me a little bit like an approach to college. We're going to assume you can meet high standards. We're going to assume that you can be given responsibility and use it wisely. And that has really paid off. Attendance is up. Dropout rate is down. It's now below 2%. And discipline referrals are down, too. So it was sort of nice to see Franklin transform over all these years.
Great news. NHPR's Anne-Marie Timmons. Anne-Marie, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
You can find more of her work, again, at nhpr.org. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR.